Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's story is about vanishing ice, but not the kind you're thinking of. It is a Canadian ritual. It's part of our national myth. It gets cold, dad or mom throws up some boards, hauls out the hose, floods the ground, and boom, backyard rink. It's a staple of winter, as long as it's cold enough. We talk a lot here about the big world-destroying problems that climate change is going to bring down on our heads. But sometimes it's worth looking at the ways that this stuff will actually impact the things in our lives that have always been there. The things we assumed always would be there, like cold winter afternoons out on the rink or the ski hill. And it's more than nostalgia. For a lot of kids in this country, the public outdoor hockey rinks are the only place they can really practice. They're always open. They don't charge for ice time, and you can just mess around the way we're always taught that these legends of the game did back when they were kids. So what would Canada look like without the backyard rinks? How quickly are we approaching that threshold? What do the volunteers who spend their winters caring for this ice worry about when they put down a fresh sheet? And what about, you know, all the other winter sports? We do, after all, have a whole Olympics built around this stuff. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Stanley Kay is a news director at Sports Illustrated, and rather than talk about floods or hurricanes or heat waves, he's writing about climate change and winter sports. Hi, Stanley.
Thanks so much for having me on.
No worries. We wanted to talk to you because we love winter sports in Canada, obviously, and you wrote a piece that was profoundly depressing, I think, to a lot of Canadians.
Wow. I didn't mean to depress you guys like that, but it is depressing. It is depressing a little bit. And it's only because what you guys have in your winter sports culture is profoundly beautiful.
Yeah.
That this issue is so depressing.
Well, so tell me a little bit about it. And to preface this, in the middle of there's never any shortage of bad reports about climate change and forest fires and sea level rise and flooding, you're writing about climate change and hockey and skiing. Why?
Well, for a few reasons. One, obviously, I work for Sports Illustrated, and it's one of the ways that sports is going to be affected the most, especially these winter sports. At least right now, winter sports are probably being affected more than other sports. But I think there's also something to the idea that while climate change is going to have devastating effects all around the world, like you mentioned, sort of catastrophe, right? Stronger storms, sea level rise, wildfires, all of these sort of, you know, really detrimental effects that are going to hurt societies, civilizations, and just the planet ecologically. But one of the ways people really relate to the climate, especially in a place like Canada or the northern US, is by the sports we play. So in many respects, all of these sort of catastrophic effects of climate change. I'm from Florida. Sea level rise is definitely posing a threat to Florida. But, you know, it still seems in many ways far in the future, even though Miami Beach does regularly flood these days. But you start to talk to someone about something like hockey or skiing or snowboarding or any one of these sports, and it's really a way that people can relate to it. It seems much more real than a polar bear, the image of a polar bear that's stranded on some melting ice or something like that.
Right.
So, yeah, it's very profound. And also, the sports that people play, these sports, whether it's outdoor hockey, skiing, etc., you know, they're meaningful. They are sort of a way of life, especially in Canada.
So tell me about how you kind of went about quantifying exactly what's happening. Tell me, like, what is a good skating day? Because that's kind of where your story starts.
Sure. So there's been a lot of different academic research conducted on the subject of winter sports and climate broadly. A lot of this is focused on, especially I'd say, skiing and mountain sports, because snowpack and all of that in mountains is really important, not just for skiing, but for our water supply and all sorts of other, you know, reasons that are profoundly important to society. But one of the reasons I wanted to focus on outdoor skating is because, you know, hockey is this very mainstream sport. Obviously, it's huge in Canada. And the outdoor ice rink has been a really significant aspect of hockey going back for generations. If you talk to NHL players or you hear from them, especially around the Winter Classic or the Stadium Series or any one of these sort of outdoor games that the NHL puts on that really celebrates the game's outdoor roots, you'll hear players talk about how their best hockey memories are not even necessarily playing in a game in the NHL, but playing as a kid on the outdoor ice. So it's really an important cultural institution in the northern United States and Canada and Europe as well. So in order to quantify sort of what is a good skating day, you talk to different people, they have sort of different ideas of this. But, you know, the basis of it is that you probably want, you know, the temperature to be fairly well below the freezing point. And the important thing here is that it can't just be like freezing for one day and then you get an ice rink. It has to be several days of sustained freezing weather. And that's really important to develop a quality ice surface. So when you talk to people who actually make these rinks, whether in the backyard or in a community park or wherever, they always talk about keeping a constant eye on the 10-day or two-week forecast to see if there's going to be any sort of thaw coming up. And that's the thing that's really presenting a challenge to outdoor ice makers these days, is that you're getting more of these sort of winter thaw events. It's not that thaws didn't happen 30, 40, 50 years ago. They did in January. You're just getting more and more of them. And a lot of times when there's a thaw, you kind of have to start from square one, unless you have some sort of liner or other sort of adaptive material attached to your rink that helps you sort of pool the water. But basically, you know, if all that water runs off, you got to start again. And it makes it just much more challenging to actually maintain quality outdoor ice.
So you looked into a couple of places in Canada where they kind of try to quantify this and keep track. How is it changing?
I'd say that one of the main ways it's changing, and I visited Brantford, Ontario, which is, as you might know, Wayne Gretzky's hometown. It's also produced a number of other NHL players. It's a town of maybe about 100,000, about an hour, hour and a half from Toronto.
The epicenter of backyard rinks, for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, Wayne Gretzky is famous for growing up skating on a backyard rink. He's definitely talked a lot about how that rink sort of informed the way he plays the game. But one of the ways that these sort of climate changes are making things harder for rink makers is it's just the fluctuations, basically. You'll still get these really good quality winters where there are a lot of skating days, but it kind of depends year to year. There's just much more variability right now. But there are organizations and there have been studies that have tracked this sort of thing. So it's not just anecdotal evidence. You know, you talk to rink makers, they'll say, oh, well, we used to get 5 or 6 weeks of skating days a year. Now it's 3 or 4. And that's anecdotal and that's fine. And you'll definitely hear that a lot. But there's also now these sort of longitudinal studies that have sort of projected skating days in the past and in the future. So one such organization that maintains these studies is this organization called Rink Watch. It's basically a citizen science project run by climate scientists from Wilfrid Laurier University. And what they've basically found by collecting rink data from about 1,500 different rink makers mostly in North America, also a couple in Europe, is that skating days have fallen in the Greater Toronto Area by about 25% from the levels that they were at in the 50s, 60s, and 70s to today. So that's a pretty substantial drop. Yeah. It doesn't mean that it doesn't get cold anymore. It doesn't mean that you can't skate or that outdoor skating isn't part of it, but it's definitely gotten harder to maintain that outdoor ice through the winter because you're getting more of these thaw events. And what that leads to is you might have rink makers who maybe aren't as committed to their outdoor ice. You know, building a rink is really, really difficult. It takes a lot of work. You have to flood the ice every night. You have to scrape the ice every night. It's, you know, many hours a week. And if the rink is thawing 4 or 5 times a winter, some people might just throw their hands up and say, you know what, it's not worth it. And it would be totally understandable for them to do that. So it's very possible to maintain, you know, a good rink and get a few weeks of skating these days, but it's an arduous process. And what you're seeing, I think, is people saying, you know what, maybe it's not worth it to put up my rink this year because, you know, we might only get 3 or 4 weeks of skating. And you're definitely seeing the start of the skating season push back a little bit further as well, to where now it's like you're lucky if you get outdoor skating by the Christmas holidays.
I really like that you use kind of anecdotal and research data on this, because I feel like this issue speaks within the same framework as that, global warming denial of, well, it was so cold yesterday, you know, how can there be global warming when it's winter everywhere, et cetera, which is something that comes up very often. But you're sort of working in the framework of just these are things that we're used to doing that we're not able to do as much anymore.
That's definitely true. And that's really important to note. You know, you could still get a great winter. Next winter, you could have, 6 weeks of skating or something like that. And it doesn't mean that climate change isn't true just because in Brantford or Toronto or Montreal, there was a lot of skating. It just, the overall trend is that there's less and less skating days these days, which is definitely posing a challenge to people who really value backyard rinks and community rinks like they do in Brantford. They have this really sort of robust community rink program. It's pretty amazing, actually, where they have this team of volunteers that basically maintains about 27 rinks in 20 different parks that are completely free to use. And you'll see kids out there skating, adults, and it's really like a part of the community there. So to see that sort of heritage threatened is a bit sad. They're dealing with other sort of issues as well. Of course, they have to figure out funding for maintaining the rinks. There's this decline in volunteerism that's a challenge. But the long-term threat here is global warming. And outdoor ice skating will be part of the culture in Canada going forward for a while, especially out west in like Calgary and Edmonton maybe won't feel the effects of climate change as much as Eastern Canada, at least in these next few years. It might take a little bit longer to set in there, but you're definitely going to have less skating days. And that poses a challenge to just the culture there. And it also might pose a challenge to the development of NHL players. We'll see.
Well, yeah, especially because when you lose those outdoor rinks for part of the time, that means that the people who are skating are the folks who can afford to pay for ice time, which takes hockey in Canada from something of a meritocracy, because anybody can get out on the ice, to something that you really need to be able to pay for if you want to play it.
That's a really great point. I think accessibility is absolutely key here. Just think about in the United States, think about if all of a sudden, for some reason, you couldn't play basketball outdoors and you could only play indoors, how much that would change the sport. That's something that I think we're looking at here, where it's just going to become much more difficult. It's not that outdoor skating is not going to exist, but it's really expensive to maintain artificial outdoor ice where you have like a refrigeration system.
Right.
Most cities and smaller municipalities can't afford that. They definitely can't afford like more than one or two. So it just completely changes the nature of the game. And you think about that unstructured play and how important that is, and how important that is to sort of the Gretzky legacy and really the Gretzky lore, as well as the lore of so many different NHL players. It's like soccer in Brazil, sort of, is the way I look at it. That sort of unstructured play, you know, playing in the streets or whatever, is why Brazil developed so many great soccer players. I think the same is true in the northern United States and Canada for the development of hockey players. Not to say that it's necessary. You have someone like Austin Matthews of the Toronto Maple Leafs who grew up playing in Arizona. There's no outdoor ice there, obviously, at least not natural ice. So it's definitely going to have an effect, I would think, on the NHL. I think the NHL will be totally fine. There will still be plenty of great hockey players. But the key, I think, really is just for people who might not be able to afford playing indoors. Ice time is expensive. Not everyone lives in a city like Toronto where you're going to have multiple outdoor ice rinks that are artificially refrigerated. So it just makes it a little bit harder to, you know, sort of pick up the fundamentals of skating and to sort of have those outdoor experiences and unstructured play that are sort of integral to the outdoor ice experience in a community like Brantford.
Hockey aside, which is difficult for me to say as a Canadian, your piece also chronicled some ways in which some sports have already changed, and I didn't know this. Can you sort of list off a few of those?
Sure. So, you know, you always have to, when it comes to climate change, you always have to be careful just pointing out one sort of event and saying, oh, this,
yeah,
you know, the cancellation of this event is a result of climate change. But what we can say is that climate change is what the military might call a threat multiplier. So it makes sort of the destabilization of various sporting events a little bit more likely. A good example is the Iditarod in Alaska, the sled dog race. basically, you know, there are certain areas where maybe sea ice is less solid than it used to be, or the course has had to reroute sort of in search of snow and ice that maybe were more, you know, were more guaranteed 20, 30, 40 years ago. So that's one example. There's also, you know, there's cross-country skiing races, sort of speed skating races in the Netherlands. I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, honestly, for this podcast, because I feel like I would butcher it. But there are basically these sporting events all over the world that are sort of having to adapt. A lot of skiing, you know, Nordic skiing, downhill, you know, rely on snowmaking these days. So you're seeing already like the disruption of these sporting events like pond hockey tournaments, things like that. But I think the concern is much less at the elite level, which, you know, a lot of these sort of events have the ability to adapt, whether it's through snowmaking or other sort of adaptation strategies, and much more about just like the average person who's trying to connect to winter recreation by participating in these activities, whether that's outdoor ice or any sort of sport like that. It just, you know, the elites might be fine. Skiing can use snowmaking for the elite competition. But, you know, for the average person who wants to go to their local ski hill, and suddenly that ski hill is having a much harder time staying in business because they have to spend so much more money on snowmaking and they're not getting as much natural snow and snow cover is dissipating, you know, that's where the real challenge is going
to
be.
Well, when you talk to those average folks for the store, the people who are trying to make backyard rinks or run the local ski hill or whatever, and they're realizing that it's harder, how much do they blame climate change for it? And is it something that they consciously think about, or what?
It's a good question. I talk to a lot of people who volunteer to maintain these community rinks in Brantford. And I think a good amount of them understand that something is changing, that the climate is changing. Not everyone is, you know, fully sort of worried about climate change. And some of them definitely mentioned a couple arguments that have sort of been parroted by what we've called climate deniers over the years. But most of them understand that something is changing. And I think that that's really key. You have people who participate in snow sports and, you know, whether that's skiing, outdoor hockey or whatever, that are very much in touch with the climate and are very much in touch with the weather. And they understand how important weather and climate are to these sort of outdoor pastimes. So in a lot of cases, you have these sort of snow athletes, you know, whether they're elite athletes or just, you know, beer league hockey players that maybe are seeing the changes faster than almost anyone else, besides climate scientists and other sort of academics. But one thing I would say is that some of these volunteers in Brantford have been volunteering for dozens of years. I talked to one guy who's been volunteering to make community at his community ice rink for 48 years, which is just an astounding fact considering how much work it takes every week to actually maintain outdoor ice. And, you know, he's definitely noticed. I mean, it's been nearly five decades for him, and he's noticed that it's gotten harder to maintain that outdoor ice because of these thaw events, because the winters are a little warmer. So they're very in touch with the winter and how that sort of, how the general weather patterns and climate patterns affect these sports. And, you know, most of them are sort of trying to reckon with, you know, the long-term effects here. And it's one of those things where a lot of people in the climate world will talk about mitigation and adaptation and sort of how those strategies, you know, which strategy we should take to deal with climate change. Should we try to mitigate it? Should we try to adapt to the changing climate? Should we do a combination of both? And obviously any one person is, you know, can't really do much to mitigate climate change because it's a problem that requires, you know, sweeping global coordinated action. But, you know, you're seeing a lot of these sort of outdoor rink makers try to adapt and figure out ways that they can adjust to these thaw events and warmer winters and try to keep this tradition going as long as possible.
Thanks, Stanley.
Of course.
Stanley Kay is a news director at Sports Illustrated. That was The Big Story. You want more big stories? Go to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You will find them all there. You can also find us with our brother and sister shows at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can hit us up on social media at TheBigStoryFPN on Twitter or FrequencyPods on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And find us wherever you get podcasts. Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, Make up your favorite one and stick that in there. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.